You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Asad Raza. Asad, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd.
Asad, we're talking about your show at 3A Gallery in New York. GA is for Gaia. And, of course, this is a video installation. We're going to talk more about it, but let's begin with it with a title. GA is for Gaia, if I'm saying that correctly. Can you tell me a little bit about what that means?
Sure. You know, in 2014, I did a project in Athens, in Greece. And during the off days of that project, I lived in Athens for about 3 months. And every week on my off day, I would go to different places. One week I went to Delphi, and it was amazing to actually be there and to feel the landscape, and the sense that you were in some sort of a sacred place was very clear. It was very clear why this had become the location for all of these shrines and religious activities, which, you know, we all know about now, especially, of course, the most famous being for us, the Oracle at Delphi. And when I went there, I was reading about the origins of that practice, and it turns out that the oracles were sort of later co-opted by the priests of Apollo, who would basically interpret the ravings of a person who they would expose to these sulfuric gases that were coming out of the earth there. But before, the sort of priests had taken over interpreting ravings, there were a group of witches who used to worship a deity there called GA, or GI, depends. I mean, you know, it was ancient Greek, so I'm not sure exactly how they pronounced it. That name later evolved into the goddess of earth, Gaia. And so when I was making this video series, or this on, when I'm still making it, because it's an ongoing video, which I keep adding segments to, where I'm really thinking about the landscape and the waterscapes of earth and how they hold certain kinds of thoughts, or how we can still encounter the history of certain kinds of thoughts about the planet by going to certain places. I thought that would be an interesting thing to go back, like not just to the idea of Gaia, which has now become known for the theory that the Earth is a living system, but even the goddess that preceded Gaia.
That's so interesting. So in a way, it's the, you know, when you talk about the oracles at Delphi and how they were co-opted, you know, this is such a kind of old story in kind of religions and how they evolve and work, right? So are these, is this video in a way, is a continuation of that co-opting, how it keeps changing and shifting, or no?
I mean, I'd like to say it's more like a recovery of certain moments. So the way it started was the Serpentine Gallery has a general ecology program, and they did a conference in 2020, and it was the COVID time, and they asked me to contribute. And normally that would have meant, you know, going to London and doing some sort of a talk or event live in front of their audience. And of course, it being the pandemic, I couldn't do that. So I was thinking, you know, Zoom was sort of boring by December 2020 to me. And I had myself done a digital platform called Home Cooking, where I interviewed a lot of artists and curators on Zoom. So I told them, you know, their topic was the ecology and the ground, and the name of that event was the understory of the understory, meaning the understory of the ground and soil. And so I proposed to them that I would go and make a filmic portrait of the landscape around James Lovelock's house. Now, James Lovelock was the engineer, just passed away a couple of years ago, but was still alive in 2020, you know, came up with the Gaia theory, that the Earth is a living system of feedback loops, that is sort of regulating itself, in which life is helping to regulate the climate so that it doesn't, you know, so we don't all burn up or freeze. And his, you know, one of the most compelling points of evidence for his theory is that the sun is 20% hotter now than it was when life first began on Earth. And yet the climate of the planet has stayed relatively stable. And so he was interested in how that happened. But I was interested in something else about James Lovelock, which is that he had this incredible insight, in my opinion, into the way that the planet functions, as well as a lot of other insights. He was an inventor and an engineer who worked with NASA and invented ways to measure the possibility of life existing on other planets by looking at the gas compositions. But in addition to all that, he never worked in a laboratory or a museum. He worked at home, basically in his garage, and he always lived on the seaside in a cottage, first in Devon, and then he would spend the summers in Ireland and then in Dorset in England. And so I just had this thought that there must be something about that landscape and being able to see the exchange of energies between the water and the land and the air every day that maybe was, you know, was helpful to him or helped to provoke these thoughts. So I proposed to the Serpentine to go there and make a portrait of the landscape around his house. And that became the first segment of this video, which we're showing at 3A Gallery.
And you know, so that's so fascinating about him, who, of course, I know a bit of. So when we talk about the landscape around his house, which, you know, of course, is in many ways an homage to him and this work, you're talking about Gaia itself and trying to get at or illustrate or create metaphors or points of entry for understanding the idea of Gaia?
I would see it less like a tribute to James Lovelock, although I think James Lovelock is a very interesting and worth reading figure, and more like my attempt to understand the Gaia theory itself as sort of co-authored by James Lovelock and this land and waterscape that he was part of. And when you went there, when I arrived there, it was just immediately a place where you felt the sense of churning energy exchange. And, you know, the weather was constantly kind of approaching from across the sea and moving over you. We had like four different seasons in 2 days. There was hail, there was rainstorms, there was sunny blue skies, there was, you know, gloom. It was just, it was a place of intense energy exchange. And when we walked, we ended up walking about a mile up the hill. His house is sort of on a hill overlooking the English Channel. It's a really beautiful spot. But a mile up the hill, with an even grander kind of vista over the sea, we found an old Neolithic circle, you know, like a few thousand years old, of stones that had been placed in a circle because of this spot having a certain kind of sacred vista, which really reminded me of Delphi, the kind of vista across the land that you got from up there. So in a way, I guess what I'm saying is that, like, those ancient practices like making these stone circles or creating the shrines at Delphi and James Lovelock's thinking about the planet are all being provoked by the planet itself in some way, at least. And that's why I say kind of co-composed by the planet. And that's what I was interested in sort of trying to suggest. So that's why in the film, I didn't talk to James Lovelock himself or film him. It's not a biopic or a kind of tribute to him alone. It's more like a kind of recording of this collaboration that's always going on between you know, us as denizens of the planet and the overall living system of the planet.
I like that. And to talk about to kind of zoom back a little bit, or zoom out on your practice, you're making a film here, a video, but your work also encompasses many more things, right? Writing and curating and teaching and organizing. Can you tell me a little bit about how your other practices fit into this, or how they have become or are a part of this?
Sure. I think, you know, like most people these days, I think I do a lot of different things, like you. I would say though that in terms of my art practice, I'm not particularly known for doing video or film, even though I did study filmmaking at NYU, and I've made feature films and, you know, this project. Mostly what people I think know about my work is these larger installations, such as Diversion, where we, you know, rerouted the or diverted part of the Main River through the Porticus Gallery in Frankfurt, or Absorption, where we make artificial soil and fill a museum or exhibition space with it, or I think people are aware of Root Sequence Mother Tongue, where we grow trees in the museum and then make a grove of trees afterwards somewhere that is supposed to be protected for at least a century. So those kinds of projects I call metabolisms because they're all about processes rather than being about static arrangements of objects or materials in a pictorial frame. I'm very interested in thinking about art as something that can also create active processes, like a metabolic process. And so, you know, with diverting the river through the gallery, you had the river constantly flowing from the beginning of the show to the end, and visitors could actually walk in the channel. And one of the things I was most focused on, which we accomplished, was I wanted to be able to filter and clean jugs of the river water and offer that to the visitors to drink. And that turned out to be one of the most kind of emotional aspects of the project when I saw people drinking the water from the mine, and then they became emotional, some of them, because I think because they had lived in Frankfurt their whole lives and then never drank the water from the river that they crossed, you know, multiple times every day for their entire life, which is normal for all of us because we live in, you know, all the cities in the world are built on rivers, and all of those rivers are unsafe to drink the water from. So it's a pretty normal state of affairs. But in any case, those works, which I call metabolisms, are generally pretty large in scale, and they're not so easy for me to show in small galleries or places that don't have, you know, ambitious, you know, want to do a really ambitious project. And I think 3A Gallery is a place I was very excited to do something because it's run by Mieko Meguro, who's a good friend and who's the who was the partner of Dan Graham, who was a mentor of mine. And so I thought to show this piece made sense there. But also, and this brings up something that we didn't cover yet, I think of it also as a somewhat active piece because I keep adding segments to it. And the most recent segment, which is on view also at 3A, is was filmed in southern Germany, and it's actually a film portrait of this hilltop where Hildegard von Bingen was in, you know, put into a monastery when she was 16, and it's where she had all these famous visions, and where she wrote her music and wrote a lot of these famous texts that she's known for now, 1,000 years later. So there's new segments still in my mind. I really want to go to the mangrove in Martinique and the landscape and waterscape around where Edouard Glissant, the poet and philosopher, was from. And actually, I have had an offer to do a residency with the Edouard Glissant Art Fund, which has just started. So I'm excited to hopefully get to do that. And, you know, I want to keep making these segments so that the film continues to keep changing and growing.
I like that. So let's talk about how it will change and grow because this is now touring, right? It will move from 3A and keep traveling. Is that what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I've been showing it in various places, and I assume that I will show it again soon. I'm not sure exactly what the next stop will be, although the Front Triennial in Ohio, which I was an artist in 2022, and I'm serving as the artistic director of in 2025, the executive director of that just asked if they could host the latest version at some point in the next year or so. So that might be the next stop on the tour. But yeah, it keeps moving around.
And so when this moves around, part of what this generates, right, is also a conversation. This is very much interactive in the sense that it's a process that people can not only often literally interact with, like stepping into the river, but also changing the viewer's perspective on the system, the many elements of what provides life. So if that's accurate, and I'm not going too far, does the conversation change as the work moves to different areas, whether it's this piece or other pieces? But it generates a conversation. Is that correct?
I mean, I think that's the whole point. I think it's not just correct. It's the whole point. I think that's something that Douglas Gordon said once, is that an object is an excuse for a conversation. And I feel like, you know, for me also, that was part of what art did for me, is allowed me to think about and talk about things that I didn't know how to process, or that I was somehow stuck, you know, that things that times when I felt stuck, it was often either art or music that helped me somehow continue to move and process. And in the case of Guy, there's also another element of that, which is the audio descriptions. So I created a kind of set of like what are called image descriptions, where, you know, for the visually impaired, you hear descriptions of what's on the screen while you're watching. And then I also created a set of subtitles, which, you know, are for someone who is maybe doesn't, you know, isn't listening to the sound, or is doesn't is not able to listen to the sound. And those two things don't match. So there's other sort of strands of information in the piece that you can key into or not. And in the gallery version, I actually show the whole piece once through without subtitles and image description. And then it repeats once through with all of that. And so you get all of that information and you can focus on strands of it if you want. And then it gets back to the version without again. So the whole play between describing and being is sort of baked into the piece.
And yeah, that makes sense that it is baked into the piece. And how does audiences react to that? Do, you know, as you were saying, that idea of generating a conversation is part of the work and should be. That's what art is, hopefully or largely about. Has there been conversations that are memorable to you, or that are particularly poignant in terms of how the work is communicating?
It was actually amazing to me that at 3A Gallery, a bunch of different people came to me and said that they found the piece very peaceful or very almost soothing. And I hadn't particularly thought about that. So it wasn't like I minded an interesting thing. And then a few other people told me that there seemed to be this great concentration through the entire piece on water, like that the whole thing was in a station on water. And that was interesting to me because, you know, in pre-Socratic Greek philosophy, there was Thales, the first pre-Socratic. And Thales, I believe, was known for two things. One, the idea that the earth was alive, so similar to Lovelock. And two, that everything was made of water, I believe. So it was really funny to hear people kind of making that point about the film, which, again, something I intended at all. But I'm sure that, you know, that doesn't mean it's not there. The other thing that was very, for me, gratifying was when I showed the film in, I had a show last summer in Museon in Bolzano, and someone wrote a piece about it there where they compared the film to a sort of more recent strand of work by mothers. And of course, you know, I'm not a mother, but one segment of the film does show me and my daughter, who at the time was two or one and a half, making artificial soil in the kitchen. And this writer talked about how this was a father artist, but whose work was somehow functioning in a way, offering a kind of care for the viewer that felt similar to some of these, some works by artists who were also mothers. And I found that very moving and kind of gratifying. Again, not something that I had thought of myself, but just to hear that response was powerful.
That is powerful. I want to ask you one more question, sort of a little off topic. What are you reading at the moment?
That's a great question, actually. I just got this book, which is relevant to the things we've been talking about, called The Earth Transformed by Peter Frankopan. So I'm taking a look at that. And then the other thing, which I just got to my house, is Candide by Voltaire, which I haven't read since I was about 18. And I was suddenly gripped through a conversation with my aunt, who is an extremely well-read person and someone who's memorized a lot of poetry. We talked about Candide, and suddenly I realized I need to read that again.
Well, that's so interesting. Asud, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work and more. And for those who are seeing this before March 2nd, there's links here so that they can see it at 3A Gallery. Again, Asud, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No problem. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.